Bida Mustafi is an Iranian-American member of Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to end sanctions against the people of Iraq. Since 1996, they have led almost 50 delegations to Iraq, a crime punishable by 12 years in prison and $1 million fine. Bida visited Iraq in November and December of 2002.
Unfortunately, what we've seen throughout the media coverage of this and any sort of dialogue or press conference that our government has issued or had, there hasn't really been much of a voice for Iraqi people or any indication of what their lives look like in the present. And that's unfortunate because you can't talk about the face of war unless you talk about people's ability to survive it. Most of us have been lucky enough never to live in the type of war situation that Iraqis are currently faced with today. Now, I say this knowing what happened in the United States on September 11th, because I was in New York. I was in Manhattan at the United Nations at a press conference and told to run out of the building and keep running. So I know what that felt like, but I also know what it feels like for Iraqis right now. Because anybody that you would talk to or interact with would tell you exactly what it meant for them to live under 12 years of sanctions and continued bombing. As US citizens, those of us who are, we are directly accountable for what has happened to Iraqis in these last 12 years, directly, because much of the foreign policy of our country directed at Iraq has contributed to the condition of Iraqis today. Just to give you an idea and a face of what that condition is, I want to give you some UN statistics, United Nations statistics, compiled by humanitarian coordinators that are on the ground in Baghdad and in different cities throughout Iraq. 70% of the children under the age of 5 are chronically malnourished, suffer from acute respiratory infection, and constant diarrhea. 60% of women are anemic. 60% of the population of Iraq relies on food rations that are distributed to them by the government with the help of the United Nations. That means today, as war ensues, 60% of the population is not receiving their monthly food rations, food they rely on to survive. In addition, you have to keep in mind that in 1991, during the Gulf War, civilian infrastructure in Iraq was systematically bombed by the United States coalition forces. This was precision-guided weapons. It has not been disputed that this was the case, because what we saw in months following the war was revealed documents saying, indeed, from Pentagon officials that, yes, they targeted the civilian infrastructure to further the effect of what economic sanctions would have on the people of Iraq. That means we knowingly contributed to the deaths of thousands and now upwards of 1 million children in Iraq. Just in 1996, those of you who remember seeing the interview on 60 Minutes that Madeleine Albright had, she was asked, since sanctions have been quoted by the United Nations as contributing directly to 500,000 deaths of children, what did she have to say in response to that? And Madeleine Albright retorted by saying, "We think the price is worth it." Sanctions were implemented in 1990, August of 1990, immediately after the invasion of Iraq into Kuwait, as a threat of sorts to Saddam Hussein, saying, if you don't leave Kuwait, these sanctions are going to be implemented. Sanctions, in essence, are an embargo on the country that doesn't allow anything inside and it doesn't allow anything to leave, so no imports or exports. And what happened was, once the sanctions were implemented under Resolution 661, they never had an expiration date, which meant that despite the fact that the Gulf War ensued and that Saddam eventually was forced out of Kuwait, despite the fact that weapons inspections ensued, sanctions were never lifted. Up to 1996, what you saw was this grave humanitarian condition. What happened thereafter was you had the Sanctions Committee, which is essentially the Security Council, most of the members saying, wait a second, these sanctions need to be lifted. Thereafter, you had the US and the UK continually vetoing any resolution that called for the lifting of the sanctions. In order for us to cover up somewhat of the humanitarian condition, we proposed, instead of lifting the sanctions, oil for food. And in 1996, oil for food was implemented. Prior to 96, Iraq wasn't doing any trading. This is a country that prior to the sanctions imported 70% of its food. With Oil for Food, they were allowed to sell a chunk of oil in exchange for humanitarian goods that they would request. 13% of the revenues that they would get would have to go to reparations to Kuwait. Again, something that never had an expiration date on it. And some of it would go to UN staff that's working and living in Baghdad, weapons inspectors, and what have you. Then you have the dilemma of these holds. For various different reasons, from products that were considered dual use, which meant that they could be used to build weapons of mass destruction, as well as something else, were banned. Now, the something else could have been chemotherapy medicines needed to cure cancers, tires needed for cars, pipes needed to repair infrastructure. At one period of time, chlorine was on the dual use list. UNICEF particularly was saying, no, we need chlorine in this country. The water is so contaminated, the infrastructure isn't good. We need it to be able to clean up the water. So what happens is from the minute chlorine enters the country to the minute it leaves containers or the barrels of it, they're monitored by the United Nations. Why can't that happen to other things? Well, because what we've seen is $5 billion worth of holds on Iraqi requests for materials. Holds that are requests that have gone through the Security Council, but because they never got the check or the okay from the U.S., sometimes because the U.S. wasn't willing to put enough staff on reviewing the lists, and sometimes because they would skirt around it so much to avoid it that they would never actually approve it. And this has continued to be awful because you have people who are in immediate need of the things that are on this list, but we've continuously curtailed any ability to relieve some of the situation. The best and most articulated understanding of how sanctions have worked is an article by Joy Gordon called Cool War, and it was in Harper's Magazine.
Countering the dehumanizing detachment of the typical coverage of Iraq, Bida Mustafi of Voices in the Wilderness offers us the faces of those who suffered the direct consequences of American foreign policy.
Now, our government, in building up to this war, promising a shock and awe, promising the use of weapons we've never seen, saying this will be a war that has been like no other. We have to keep in mind, they mean that, indeed. We've seen that with the pictures on television of the smoke and the bombing, but that they also mean that it doesn't really matter what happens to Iraqis. We've named that collateral damage, which is obscene. It's absurd that we have named civilian lives collateral damage of war. While I was living in Baghdad, I got to interact with many Iraqis who know very much, very personally, what war is. What we lack is that connection, that human connection, that would cause us to seek out alternatives to war as another option to any political conflict that we see. One is a woman by the name of Im Haider, who's a remarkable woman. She lives in the southern city of Basra in the Jumhuriya community. Now, I want to describe the community to you a bit because it speaks a lot to the human condition of Iraqis. It has unpaved roads. Many of the latrines and the sewage flows throughout the streets, and it's not covered well at all. The homes are cave-like. They have one window, if at all, that they've carved out themselves in almost every home that I visited. The families are enormous in number, 8 to 9 children per family, and the jobs that were once available to these people have now been robbed from them virtually because of sanctions, because within a year of sanctions, the inflation in the country was 2,000%, and people's wages were 1/10 of what they were prior to sanctions. So people who are lucky enough to not have lost their jobs are now just trying to struggle with what they do make to provide for their families. Im Haider is an English teacher. She, in January 1999, was inside her home washing dishes when a cruise missile hit her street during Operation Desert Fox. Now, you know, we know about the Gulf War. We know sanctions were implemented. We don't really know necessarily what the effects of sanctions have been unless we've studied it. But do we know that for the last 12 years, we've continuously been bombing Iraq? Just in 1999, not even Operation Desert Fox, per se, 144 civilians were killed. While I was in Baghdad and Basra, I heard air raid sirens and I was told that bombs had dropped nearby. In Basra, I could feel the ground shake. This has been consistent policy, that we feel comfortable bombing the country. Our government does, I should say. Umm Haider was washing dishes in her house while her two boys were playing outside. As soon as the missile hit the street, for obvious reasons, she was scared and ran outside in search of her kids. They were 4 years old. Mustafa and Haider were their names. She eventually found them, and unfortunately, Haider was killed almost instantaneously, and Mustafa badly maimed. I asked Umm Haider if Mustafa remembered the tragedy that happened to him, and she said, well, I asked him if he remembered what his brother said, if his brother said anything before he died. And Mustafa said, yes, he screamed, Mama, and then I heard nothing else. This is war. This is what it looks like for Iraqis. This is what it looks like for the people right now who are being bombarded. It's easy for us to watch, or not so easy for some of us, to watch this on television, because perhaps we'll be able to sleep at night because we'll forget about it. But they live through the night of bombing, and they're lucky if they get any sleep at all. And they fear the deaths of their children. Now, what we've been hearing every day is that we're only targeting military targets. We're only getting regime targets. I have to tell you, from being in Baghdad, that almost every single building in Baghdad is a regime target, a city of 5 million people. Currently, we have a team that's on the ground living in three different hotels in downtown Baghdad. Thankfully, electricity has been maintained and they've been able to report to us. And what they've been reporting to us is that, of course, there are civilians who are getting injured and hurt. They have had the privilege of visiting hospitals that are taking in civilians. And what they're seeing is many youth, many families, whose either houses have been hit or streets nearby have been hit. Now, I think what's important to mention is that it doesn't take a bomb hitting your house for you to be affected by it. In fact, a bomb across the river and down the street from where our hotel is, one of the hotels that our team is staying at, caused one of the windows to blow out. It's hard to avoid being affected by this if you can at all. Iraqis have repeatedly said they don't think there's a safe place for them to run to. Many of which say this because in 1991, two cruise missiles hit a bomb shelter in the Al Amariya district of Baghdad. This was a place that many people went to seek refuge in hopes that they would at least avoid the psychological torture of war. But what they found was that two cruise missiles hit the shelter and 408 people were incinerated. Inside, you can see on the walls hand marks of people who were trying to escape. It shows you that really there is no place to run and hide and be safe. So what we've seen is people who have the means, which are few and far between in Iraq because of the sanctions, escaping the cities. Our team reported a newlywed couple had escaped to the outskirts of Baghdad to their family's farmhouse. Unfortunately, the farmhouse was hit by a cruise missile. Three people died instantly, including an 8-year-old and the bride. One of our team members, who's a doctor, was at the hospital speaking to the groom, and she said he was crying incessantly. And I couldn't get him to stop. And finally, when I got him to stop, I was trying to ask him what was wrong. And he said, where is my bride? There have been hundreds of people injured and a couple hundred dead already. It's easy, I guess, to think, oh, you know, we're aware that this is what happens in war. Of course, this is what war looks like. American soldiers are dying as well. There are POWs, all of which is awful and tragic. But the question is, why? And the question is, at what expense? These children, these young people who, like you and I, deserve a life? And what capability do we have to say, no, we don't want to resolve these conflicts through war? There are other ways. Why not continuing with weapons inspections? Why would we implement sanctions for 12 years that directly contributed to a human condition that people have said is catastrophic? There were two UN humanitarian coordinators to Iraq, Dennis Holliday and Hans von Spanach, both of whom resigned because they said that they couldn't, in good conscience, remain UN humanitarian coordinators to Iraq when it was UN-implemented sanctions that was contributing to the human condition that they were seeing. It's their example that tells myself, and hopefully other people, that we need to be willing to do more. We need to be willing to sacrifice more and raise our voices more to prevent such human catastrophe in our names. The goal of Voices of the Iraq Peace Team and our continued work is not to support Saddam Hussein or his regime by any means. Rather, it's to draw the attention to what all of these things, Saddam in front of the Iraqis and the US behind them, have done to the condition of Iraqi people. What we need to keep in mind in talking about Saddam Hussein as US citizens and what our government is doing today and what it's done for 12 years is that we not only provided Saddam Hussein with his chemical and biological weapons and by selling them to him and okaying corporations to sell them to him as we did, but we turned our back on the actions that he did. We didn't actually care enough about them. He was our lackey. He did as we wanted him to do. His problem where he steered wrong was actually maintaining himself as our lackey. That doesn't excuse his actions, and it doesn't excuse what's befallen the Iraqi people by any means. But what does it say about us and our foreign policy when you have a country of 26 million people who have suffered because they've lived under a dictator? Even if you stop this war, even if you lift the sanctions, the Iraqis are still living under a dictator. Is that our job to go in and to deal with it? No, but why, as a leading nation in this world, have we continuously supported dictators? Why not actually fueling the money that we're giving to the military to resolving some of the world's problems? The U.S. ranks dead last of leading nations giving foreign aid to other countries. It's 1% of our budget. It's almost entirely military interests going predominantly to Israel, Egypt, Colombia, and Jordan. And when you talk about Iraq, it's also very important because you have countries like Israel. The general of one of the armies in Israel has come out openly and said, Iraq does not pose a threat to us. He's not posing a threat to his neighbors or Israel, which is the first country that I think would come out and say that he does. Then how is he posing an imminent threat to the United States? To follow with that, I want to quote Condoleezza Rice in the January 2000 issue of Foreign Affairs. So this was prior to September 11th. She was quoted in reference to how the administration would handle Iraq if they did have weapons of mass destruction by saying, the first line of defense should be a clear and classical statement of deterrence. If they do acquire weapons of mass destruction, their weapons will be unusable because any attempt to use them will bring national obliteration. If in January, February 2000, Iraq would be stupid to use their weapons of mass destruction if they had them, what difference is that today? Virtually none. It's just opportunity today that we say we can go ahead and do this. How do you deal with Saddam if, A, he doesn't pose a threat anymore as far as weapons of mass destruction are concerned, and, B, he's still a dictator, a ruthless dictator? Of course you lift the sanctions. An Arab journalist in 1996 was reported as saying, Iraqis don't seem to care about politics or reform anymore. They're just trying to figure out what they can eat tonight or how they can support their family. You'll see this throughout history. People who have to worry about how they're going to survive often have difficulty worrying about a revolution or their self-determination on who they want running their country. That in and of itself is important and enough of an argument to say if we actually care about who's running that country that we should be supporting the people. Help empower the people by giving them a decent life in which they would want to get up and rebel. In addition, I'm all for the implementation of Resolution 687, which was the original resolution calling for weapons inspections in Iraq, because that resolution states that not only would the weapons inspections begin in Iraq, but that it would be implemented and pursued because of the Treaty of Non-Proliferation Act, which in essence also calls for the ridding of weapons of mass destruction in the entire region. Go ahead, take them out of Israel, take them out of Egypt, take them out of Jordan, get rid of them. We shouldn't have them. We have the most weapons of mass destruction in the world. And also, why not send in inspectors in prisons, where Saddam is conducting much of his crimes against humanity and against the people of Iraq? That's where he tortures most of the people. That's where they disappear. All the people that are around him and him should be tried for war crimes.
Speaking 1 week after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Bidhar Mustafi of Voices in the Wilderness reflects on Iraqi nationalism and the resistance encountered by U.S. and British troops.
You get these different images on television of what Iraqi people are thinking, and virtually you have a society that is comprised of a lot of different religious groups and different nationalities as well. That said, there is a lot of nationalism, but it's not as divided as it's made out to us to be. They're intelligent people, you know, they're not given enough credit by any means. Do they care about their own sovereignty as Iraq, as Iraqis? Of course, they do. I would say without a doubt, there is a us and them, the us being all of Iraq. We've seen that there is fighting. You know, I think it's unfortunate that a lot of political analysts, people who have been to Iraq, their words prior to leading up to this war were completely ignored when many said, it's not going to be that easy. And it hasn't been that easy. Primarily, what I took back from Iraq was that people were saying, when is enough enough? We are tired of living in a state of war. We are tired of fearing for the lives of our children. I had people saying, do Americans think this is just a video game, that they can kill many of us watching it from afar and not realizing what's happening to us? Many just scared and anxious for obvious reasons, but that didn't mean that they didn't want change, even if it meant change in the regime. They're caught in somewhat of a catch-22, which is exactly what an Iraqi told me, that on one side of them they have this dictator and on the other they have the US and the UK, two powers that have deliberately caused so much of the strife that many have faced for 12 years. What's better for them? Neither. They don't want a foreign occupier. They know exactly what's happened to Palestinians. They don't want to be in any situation where they're left as vulnerable as they have been for 20 years. And the U.S., they know, has been a huge part of that. But what we've seen in our attempts to try to understand what's happening in the country, because we only have a team in Baghdad, unfortunately, is that nobody knows what's happening in the country. You can really go to one news source or go to 500, and I don't think you still have a really accurate idea as to what's happening in that country right now. One day they have al-Nusayriya, the next day they're saying they're still fighting. One day they're saying they're going into Basra, the next day they're saying, we're skipping Basra, we can't get it today, there's gonna be too much fighting. That's really scary. What does that mean? What's going on? My fear is that once they enter Baghdad, that soldiers will be on the verge of snapping. As I saw on a CNN interview the other night, a Marine was being interviewed, and he said, you know, this is really frustrating for us because we know we can just go in and annihilate these people. And the correspondent just went, what? He says, are you telling me that that's what's going to happen? And he says, well, no, you know, with these soldiers, they're going off of 2 hours of sleep if they're lucky. And this is really hard. And we know we have the capability of just getting this thing over with. What happens when they get to Baghdad? Are they going to snap? Is that it? That forget we're saying Iraqis need to live up to as far as the Geneva Conventions are concerned. What about what we're going to be doing? What about what we're already doing? When is enough enough? In 1991, there were two uprisings that occurred during the Gulf War, uprisings that were called for by then President Bush and are today called for by this President Bush, saying that the U.S. would help in the overthrow and lead up to Baghdad to finish the job. What you saw in 91 was in the south and southern cities like Basra, you had the Shia population primarily doing this, and in the north, the Kurds. What happened? They began the uprisings. And what the U.S. did was stand back, actually asked some of them to give them their weapons, let Saddam Hussein have access to his helicopters, and allow him to go slaughter the uprisings. Why did we do that, if that's what we wanted, if that's what we're calling for today? And if that is what we did, then why would Iraqis trust us? Many political analysts and historians who have studied this have said the U.S. has no interest in allowing these opposition groups to rise up and take control of the country. They want to dismantle those who are in power that are running Iraq and replace them with people who are virtually doing the same things to the population, but listening to what the U.S. wants at the same time. that's important when we talk about what post-war Iraq will look like. My biggest fear is that people are going to ignore, and our media is going to ignore, and our administration is going to ignore, actually telling us what's happening. What we saw right after they invaded Safwan, I think, is telling. The first day, the media was saying, oh, Iraqis are saying, thank you for coming and liberating us. Then if you paid attention as the days progressed, or even as an article went on, you saw this, wait a second, they're not so welcoming. They're scared. They know they don't want the US and the UK in power. They don't know what the next few months are going to look like for them. Ultimately, it's unpredictable, and that's really frightening. I'd say the most profound thing that we do is for Iraqis. We don't abandon them. It's about relationships, because it's not until we have these relationships where we're willing to forget about these boundaries that our governments and have drawn and actually maintain real relationships between real people, and that's how you begin the real diplomacy in the world that we hope that we can one day attain. Our team is telling us almost every day now, Iraqis are amazing. They're so strong throughout all of this. As scared as they are, they will come and try to comfort members of the Iraq peace team who are there by giving them tea or just sitting with them. Because what you'll find while you're there, what I found while I was there, was that it's unbelievable the respect and thankfulness and humility an Iraqi will show you when they realize why you're there, when they realize that you're willing to live through what they're living and that you see that there's no difference between you and them. As far as reporting, it's an attempt to shed light on the truth the way that we see it. We're trying to report what we're seeing that's not being reported. In addition, an international lawyer has trained our team that's on the ground right now to document what they see in a manner in which it could be used in the future for war crimes. The accounts that they're taking from hospital visits and what have you, we hope that we can hold those accountable that need to be held accountable. The beauty of Iraqis, at least the ones that I interacted with, that they really drew distinctions. They see a difference between American people and the American government and the policies that are acted out by our government. I fear that not many people in this country do the same. We saw that post 9/11. It's important that we keep that in mind, because that means that we have a responsibility beyond that of just being citizens of this country. There's this global movement against this. This is unprecedented. What happens around the world was, interestingly enough, covered in Iraqi media. So they would see with the protests and what have you, and it was encouraging for them. What needs to happen is a continued movement. We need to keep building it to say it doesn't end with Iraq, it doesn't end with post-war Iraq, and how we rebuild it. We need to make sure our government gets the hell out of there and gives it to Iraqis, as well as looking around the world, not just to Israel, but to Latin America, to Africa. What's happening there? We need to make sure that we're looking at this as a global movement that affects the globe entirely. We received a call to action from our team in Baghdad, asking that as April 15th approaches, that people keep in mind that it's our federal taxes, 35 cents out of every dollar, sometimes more, that go to our military, continually robbing us of money that should be going to education, to healthcare, to housing, to social services. Instead, fueling the largest military in the entire world, the largest weapons distributor in the entire world, and the country that has the most weapons of mass destruction in the world to go kill more innocent people. Their call was that people start taking it upon themselves to become war tax resistors. If you have questions on how to do this, I encourage you to get in touch with Voices or War Tax Resistors. And if you're in a position that you can't do this, go to your congressman's office, go to your senator's office, insist that you're not going to continue paying for this mass murder.
Bina Mustafi is with Voices in the Wilderness. For more information, see www.vitw.org or iraqpeaceteam.org. This is Stacey Pettigrew reporting for Wings.